Hi, Ken here. At unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. So we can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Learning from the lives of lineage holders. Kyungpo Naljor.
Okay. Now, Kyungpo Naljor lived in about the 12th century.
How do you spell his name?
Kyungpo Naljor. Yeah. Depending on the dialect, it's Kyungpo or Kyungpo. Rinpoche's dialect was Kyungpo. Now, this is the first teacher of the lineage which we have a fairly detailed biography, at least in comparison to the ones for Sukha City and Nigama. It's quite detailed. And we certainly can't cover everything about his life in one day, one evening, short period of time. I'm just going to hit a couple of the points about the earlier part of his life because I think they bring up a number of dilemmas that many of us have experienced and are quite common. Kyungpo Naljor was born into a Bun family. Bun was the indigenous Tibetan religion, at least that's the usual way that it's cast. It's not entirely clear that it was the indigenous Tibetan religion, but it was it predated Buddhism to some extent. And Buddhism and Bun have experienced a kind of rivalry which Buddhism largely won, but Bun continued and survives to the present day. There are Bun practitioners. And as often happens when you have two religions or spiritual paths that are competing with each other, they both take the best of the other. And so they come out actually very similar. The difference with Bun is that it does everything in the opposite direction of Buddhism. So in Buddhism you circumambulate, walking clockwise, and then Bun you circumambulate walking counterclockwise, so forth. Anyway, he was born into this family and studied Bun quite seriously and became a great practitioner. A master of it, and a teacher to many, many people. However, it didn't, and he was able to inspire students who had visions and all kinds of mystical experiences and things like that. So this was not a failure, but it didn't satisfy something in him. And when he was born, an Indian saint had kind of shown up on the doorstep and made all of these grand prophecies about him. And he recalled this. So he thought, I think I'll go to India and study with people there. Now, he was in his 50s at this point, which in Tibetans of that age would be equivalent to being about 70, 75 now. And the journey from India to Tibet was no joke. Much more difficult. I mean, it'd be like walking across Death Valley today or something like that. It was tough, very tough. So he gathered up a bunch of gold to make to use for offerings when he got to India. But before he went left, he went to see his parents, and his parents says, "Oh, please don't leave us. We're old. You know, India's a long way away. You may not come back, and we'd really miss you, etc." Anybody have this one?
Mm-hmm.
And he went, okay. And they said, "There's lots of good Buddhism here in Tibet. If you don't have to go to all the way to India to do that. You can do it right here at home." Anybody had this one? So he said, "Okay, fine." So he started studied Dzogchen, and in particular, he studied the what's called the mind section of Dzogchen, which is a large section. It's got about 18 different series of teachings in it. He mastered them all and had very, very good experiences, etc. But it still didn't satisfy. I mean, something was missing. And then he said, "There's no one contesting my abilities, no one debating me, no Indian adepts or translators ever translate these Bun texts, so when I ask for debate, people refuse, telling me I'm not a Dharma practitioner, I'm a Bun practitioner." So there was something missing for him. He was looking for something deeper, something to engage. So after that, he then studied with a very highly regarded Mahamudra master by the name of Nirupa. This is not to be confused with Naropa. This is Nirupa, who lived in Tibet and received many, many teachings from him, and came to understand these and practice them. And then, he says, at a certain point, Nirupa says to him, "Chungpo, now you are like me. We're equal in our realizations. You know all that I know. You're outstanding." And here's what Chungpo has to say, Chungpo Nodra has to say about this. "This raised doubts in my mind. Well, I thought, I've been taught the entire doctrine and have spontaneous devotion for the Dharma. I've studied all the teachings, yet in truth, I don't have the slightest sign of extraordinary or even common abilities. Now my Lama Nirupa is the greatest adept in Tibet. So if he says that he and I are equal, it must mean that he hasn't attained any realizations either. I think I really need to go to India." So that's what led him to set off on this path. And it may not seem so today, but Dharma didn't come cheap in those days. You know, really special teachings. You had to amass a lot of wealth. And then you went and you made these offerings, and maybe these teachers took you on, maybe they didn't. So he amassed as much wealth as he could, and went to his very wealthy uncle and then said, "Can I borrow some gold and turquoise for these teachings?" And they wouldn't support him in that, though his aunt secretly gave him some things. And then he went to India, which was, you know, you're coming from 10 or 12,000 feet where the air is totally clear and clean, down generally through Nepal, through the jungles of Nepal, which were difficult, very difficult, into a land that is just full of disease and moist, you know, it's a tropical climate. So your susceptibility to disease was extreme. A lot of people died on this. And he went to Bodh Gaya, where he studied with a teacher whose name was Dorje Denma. Now this is unfortunate, because Dorje Denma means the one who holds the seat at Bodh Gaya. And at this period in India, Bodh Gaya was kind of like the Vatican. Now, I don't know whether there was a huge bureaucracy. There may or may not have been, but there was a very important temple at Bodh Gaya, which was built well before this time. It predates that, whoever was regarded as the top person in India in Buddhism at that time was given the title Dorje Denma. So when they say Lama Dorje Denma, they're actually just saying, like, giving the title. So we don't know who this person is, really. Very little about him. But suffice to say that he was the top person. Atisha, whom many of you have heard about, had the same title. He held the seat of Bodh Gaya. And this made him virtually like the Pope, in terms of they were recognized as being the top people in terms of both understanding and experience and scholastic mastery and actually monastic tradition. So these were very, very substantial individuals. So he went and studied with Dorje Denma, and sang him this song. I, Chungpo the yogi, cannot bear the pain of samsara. Fear arises deep within me. As I see no end to this cyclic existence, the suffering of birth, the suffering of death, the suffering of the lower realms, I'm not afraid of death. Rebirth is what I fear. Based on actions, we get a certain rebirth, and in this samsara, we wander powerless. All that you and I can do is to know death comes for us too, since I could die at any time. To the Dharma, I give this life of mine. I have not stayed in Nepal. India is now my goal. With no concern for life or limb, I've left for Bodh Gaya, the place where 1,000 Buddhas will appear. To Bodh Gaya, the Vajra seat, I come with pure attitude. I see the face of Dorje Denpa, prophesied as the second Buddha by the victor Shakyamuni. I give him 500 measures of gold from Gulong. It is just like seeing the Buddha himself. My hair stands on end. I weep profusely. Genuine faith arises within me. In a fit of utter devotion, I join my hands and ask him this. Be a fountain of teachings, my monastic preceptor. Please give me the Vinaya code of discipline. Once I've aroused the great bodhicitta mind of compassion, please teach me the Mahayana doctrine. Once I have received the maturing tantric empowerments, please grant me the liberating teachings of the generation and completion stages. Now, here we have a person who has mastered three different traditions of teaching: Bun, Dzogchen, Mahamudra. And yet he feels that his understanding is not complete. This is quite significant. And what does he say his motivations are? I cannot bear the pain of samsara. Fear arises deep within me. I see no end to cyclic existence. I know death is going to come, but I don't know what's going to come after that. And what does he ask for? He asks for the monastic discipline. He wants to become a monk. And then he wants bodhicitta, the Mahayana path, and the Vajrayana path. Tantric path. So these are, here we have this great teacher. He's not asking for anything really esoteric. He's not coming with any great and glorious motivation. Every person who treads the path treads it for the same reason. We are going to die. Our life energy is consumed by reactive patterns which make a mess of our life, both for ourselves and for other people. The process is completely out of control. The only thing to do is to form the determination to step out of it completely, which is what the monastic code is about, essentially. To sustain us in this, we need to have the deeper motivation of waking up completely in order to be able to help others, which is what bodhicitta is about. And for some people, the further motivation that they're going to do this using the most powerful and profound techniques, which is what Vajrayana is about, so that they really become awake. I really become awake in this one life. This is a very, very highly trained individual. How does his motivation differ from yours? How do his concerns differ from yours?
Very little.
Yeah. What do you get from this? Chuck?
Well, he seems more willing to die.
Yeah, he's just going to
do what it takes.
Yeah. But what did he go, what brought him to that?
Well, his concern for being in samsara.
Mm-hmm. But he had
concern for the karma that he's generated for the next life.
They had to go through a few things to get to this point, didn't they?
All the training?
Well, he went through all of this training. He also had all his family stuff to work through. And what did he have to do with all of that?
Leave it behind?
Yes.
His family stuff he left behind, but his training had nothing to do with it.
Was it serving him?
His training?
Yes.
Evidently not.
Evidently not. Okay. Now, the hidden message, not that hidden in this case. Resonates with a passage that I've quoted a number of times from one of Stephen Batchelor's works. In its institutional forms, Buddhism provides very powerful answers to questions of the spirit. But sometimes the power of those answers overwhelms the stammering voice which asks the questions. Now, what happened with Chögyam Trungpa?
He still had a lot of questions.
Yeah. All of that stuff that he studied did not answer the stammering voice which was asking his questions.
That's why he didn't go to Nirvana.
I think at some point he did go to Nirvana to study with someone, but he didn't listen to the stammering voice which was asking the questions. So he got all of this teaching, a tremendous amount of teaching, and mastered it. But because he didn't listen to that voice, none of the teaching hit the mark. This is one of the reasons why I keep coming back to each of you again and again with, what is your intention in your practice? What do you want from the practice? It is so important, because here is a person who from the age of 13 to 50 was steeped in this stuff, and it still didn't hit the mark. And the only way is for you to be clear about why you're practicing and not listen to all of the reasons why you should be practicing that other people are telling you. You have to come to your own. When you do come to your own, it's extraordinary how similar they are. know, as we hear Trungpa Nalger describing. But you have to make them your own. And the only way you do that is by, you can't read about it and say, oh yes, that makes sense to me, I'll do that. That's very feeble. That doesn't work. You have to sit down and you think, you know, okay, am I going to die? Well, evidence is pretty good. Do I care about that? And you may find that you don't. And if you don't care about it, you don't have any basis for practice.
If you don't care, that you're gonna die.
Yeah. And Rinpoche, I was with Rinpoche in Hawaii, and this is our first trip, and we were on Oahu, and we were staying with a couple who retired in Hawaii, and she was a kind of strange woman, extraordinary palm reader, and just totally extraordinary. Very sweet person, and her husband was such a grouchy old retired aeronautics engineer who had no time for things mystical. So dinner was a debate between him and Rinpoche. He was just picking holes, and Rinpoche would be answering. I was doing all the translating. Great fun. And that evening, Rinpoche started off his talk, about 400 people there, in a way that I'd never heard him open up a talk before. He said, some of you may be wondering why it's important to study the Dharma, study Buddhism. Well, I want to be very clear about this. It's not important for everybody. There are three kinds of people who don't need to be here tonight. First, if there are any of you who know that you aren't going to die, you're never going to die, there's no reason for you to be here, so you might as well leave right now. Nobody left. Second is, those who know when they die, nothing happens. It's over. It's done. Nothing. If you know that, there's no reason for you to be here, so you can leave too. Third, those people who know that when they die, they're going to be born into circumstances that are definitely better than the ones that we have here. And if you know that for certain, there's no reason for you to be here tonight. It'd be just a waste of your time. But if you don't know one of those three things, then maybe you should stick around. I'm sure he's talking to our grouchy old engineer. But the point here is, it's not enough to hear it from somebody else. You can take in those teachings, but you've got to think about them and think about them and think about them until, you know, right, I am going to die. And if I die like I am now, I'm not going to feel very good about it. I feel I won't really have done anything meaningful in my life. And I'll have these questions that I haven't answered. And I will die with regret. And that has to become very, very strong. And that's the shade and flavor of it is actually a little different for everybody. It can be expressed in general terms, that it really has to become one's own experience and motivation. You cannot adopt that as a motivation without having gone through the process of making it your motivation. And you make it your motivation by really thinking about what is important, deeply, deeply important to you in your life. You follow? That is absolutely essential. And this is why, and then you come to what you want from your practice. And I ask people this. And sometimes I get different answers. And that's fine, because each person has their own answer. Some people, they say, I want clarity. Okay. And other people say, I want peace. That's fine. And other people say, I just want to understand how things are. And that's fine. And one person said, I just want to feel that I know something before I die. Which, if you think about it, that's a pretty profound thing. So, through that reflection on death, you're going to come to what's important for you. And that's where your intention is going to be. And when you have that intention, then you're going to be clear about your practice. And one of the reasons it's very important to do this is that different practices do different things. So you meditate on death and impermanence, that does one thing. You meditate on compassion, that does something else. You meditate on four measurables, that does something. You meditate on insight, that does something. Each of these practices has a different intention. What Chöngpa Namgyel did for the first part of his life